Hi everyone, I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios, New York City, and I welcome you. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Once a week we take on very serious issues, and that's what we're doing now. Today, a continuation of our ongoing series on fascism in America. Fascism is simply the bringing together of major corporate interest with political power players. Together they form allegiance to themselves. It's all about what you have to do in order to maintain your position of authority. But how does that help us? What does it do in our daily lives? I'm going to explore that today. I'm going to share some insights from Andrew Gavin Marshall from the Hampton Institute on Engineering Empire, because you cannot have fascism the way we see it today unless you have a relatively small number of people. I'm suggesting under 2,000 people in a country of over 315 million, 2,000 people working together, not necessarily in secret, they don't have to. Their institutions, their think tanks, their agenda is open. We just haven't paid attention to it, or have feared being called conspiratorial if we tried to dissect it. We're going to dissect it. And I'm going to go into depth to show you how it all works. Who are these people? How do they control so much? Domestic policy, foreign policy? Why do we see the same talking heads on all the different networks, always guiding us towards what benefits them and never us? Then I'm going to talk about, as an example, from Alternet, Alex Kane, companies that make money by keeping Americans terrified of terror attacks. I'm also going to talk about things Americans underestimate about our massive surveillance state, which seems not to bother a lot of people. They just shrug their shoulders and say, well, it's a reasonable cost for staying secure. Is it? It's what you don't know about them that should concern you. More on that from Alternet's Stephen Rosenfeld. Homeland Defense, the Pentagon Declares War on Americans, by Frank Morales. And I'll give you examples, including arresting a teenager for dozing off in class, hence why normal children's behavior is treated as a crime or a psychiatric disorder, by David Rosen. Let us begin. Right now we're told that even though there are 1.5 million children who go to school each day, but they have no home to go to when they leave school. I've actually filmed people for a new documentary on poverty that live in a car, some in a trailer, some in a van. I've actually filmed a family where he used to work at NASA and she worked at Cape Canaveral, both engineers, and they were heating noodle soup on the radiator of their car in February in a wooded area of near Titusville, Florida. And when I asked them, how did you get here? I mean, you both are highly educated, they said, and you once had a good income, two incomes together. They earned about $200,000 a year. Well, how did you go from that to being homeless and cooking a meal on the radiator of your car? And they told me the story of how they didn't believe that they couldn't get another job and get a job that paid somewhat similar to what they had been making or the type of social safety net that they had. Their health insurance was paid for. They had the American dream. But they didn't believe it would end, and then it did, and there was no one there to help them. And then they found when they went for work, there were thousands, tens of thousands of other people waiting in line ahead of them who were equally or better qualified and willing to work for less. So by the time they finally awakened and said, wow, we better get any kind of work, all the major jobs were taken. And we have those people. We have over 155 million Americans who are living at the poverty level, slightly below, above, or at the poverty level. Dirt poor. They don't have any savings, nothing. They don't have any value. They just have debt, credit card debt, mortgage debt, bills unpaid, school debt. And they're being harassed. They're being hassled nonstop. Collections agency. There's debtors' prisons now. If you don't pay your bills, you'll go to jail. But then if you're in jail, you don't have any money to pay your bills, so they charge you room and board for being in a prison. Doesn't make any sense, does it? How did we get here? Who's causing all this? Who's causing us to be able to afford wars where we spend $3 to $5 trillion in the war itself for the subsequent cost of supporting those who have been injured or rebuilding afterwards? That's what Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz says cost us in Iraq and Afghanistan. And every time one of those missiles are fired, it's $1.5 million. They don't have a problem spending money on that, but they do have a problem helping 18 million children have enough food to eat each day to stay healthy. They have a big problem when one out of every five children in the United States is living in poverty. They don't help them. No safety net. So we're kept terrified. We're kept distracted. Michael Hayden, a former director of the National Security Agency, has invaded America's television sets in recent weeks to warn about Edward Snowden's leaks and the continuing terrorist threat to America. But what often goes unmentioned, as The Guardian's Glenn Greenwald pointed out, is that Hayden has a financial stake in America's fear state, keeping Americans scared and on a permanent war footing against Islamic militants. And the private firm he works for, called Chertoff Group, is not only making money, but scaring Americans. Post 9/11 America has witnessed a boom in private firms dedicated to hyped up threat of terrorism. The drive to privatize America's national security apparatus accelerated in the aftermath of terrorist attacks, and it's gotten to the point where 70% of the national intelligence budget is now spent on private contractors. As author Tim Shurrock reported, the private intelligence contractors have profited to the tune of at least $6 billion a year. The Washington Post revealed that there are 1,931 private firms across America dedicated to fighting terrorism. What it all adds up to is a massive industry profiting off government-induced fear of terrorism, even though Americans are more likely to be killed by a car crash or their own furniture than a terrorist attack. Let me share five private companies cashing in on keeping you afraid, and these will be the ones later on I show you. How did they get these contracts? How did they end up on television? I'll share that with you. On August 11th, former National Security Agency head Michael Hayden, the man at the center of the Bush administration's 2005 surveillance scandal, was defending his former agency on CBS News in the wake of the latest National Security Agency spying scandal. Commenting on President Obama's half-hearted promises to reform some National Security Agency practices, Hayden told host Bob Schaefer that, quote, the president is trying to take some steps to make the American people more comfortable about what it is going on. That's going to be hard because, frankly, Bob, some steps to make Americans more comfortable will actually make Americans less safe, end quote. Former Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff had a similar message when he appeared on ABC News August 4th, speaking about the purported threat from Al-Qaeda affiliate in Yemen that led to the closure of 19 U.S. embassies. Chertoff said that, quote, the collection of this warning information about Al-Qaeda came from the kinds of programs we've been discussing about, the ability to capture communications overseas. CBS and ABC did not see fit to inform viewers that both Hayden and Chertoff are employees of the Chertoff Group, a private firm created in 2009 that companies hire to consult on best practices for security and combating terrorism. Some of the companies the firm advises go on to win government contracts. Chertoff is the founder and chairman of the group, while Hayden serves as a principal. So they profit off a war on terror they say is crucial to keeping Americans safe. Though it's unclear how much in total exactly the firm makes, there are some known numbers. After the failed attempt in 2010 to blow up an airliner on Christmas Day with a bomb hidden in underwear, Chertoff pushed for better airport security procedures. One of the suggestions Chertoff made was the Transportation Security Agency to use full-body scanners, like the ones that Rapiscan, one of Chertoff's group clients, made. And sure enough, after the Christmas Day plot, the TSA ordered 300 of these machines. The Huffington Post reported that the company made $118 million from the government in just 1 year. So every time you go through an airport and you go through one of those screening machines, Chertoff is making money from it. Then you have Booz Allen Hamilton. This private intelligence contractor has become a household name in the wake of the National Security Agency scandal. Edward Snowden, the man responsible for leaking secret documents that exposed the breadth of the National Security Agency surveillance, was working for Booz Hamilton when he downloaded the documents he handed off to the media outlets. As the New York Times reported, the company parlays its technology expertise for intelligence uses into massive government contracts. Thousands of employees of the company provide services to the National Security Agency, like analyzing the massive amounts of data the government agency collects every day. The company is also the shining symbol of the government-private security complex's revolving door. Its vice president is a former director of the National Security Agency, while the current director of the National Intelligence is a former employee of Booz Allen. So they go from one job to the next. They go from the National Security Agency, the Pentagon, the Defense Department, the White House, to work at Booz Allen, and then back. And despite the Snowden security breach, Booz Allen continues to work with the government. And they're making a lot of money from the U.S. In the last fiscal year, they made $1.3 billion from working in the U.S. intelligence. In total, Booz Allen made over $5 billion last year. And the cash just keeps coming. In January, the company announced that it won a contract with the Defense Department to provide intelligence services. The amount of the money it could make, $5.6 billion. And like Hayden Chertoff, Booz Allen's Vice President Mike McConnell has publicly hyped up the threat of terrorism to blast Snowden's leaks. McConnell told a government contracting conference that Snowden's leaks have done, quote, damage to the U.S. ability to stop terrorism. Quote, it's going to inhibit our ability to understand nuclear activity in North Korea, what's going on in Syria, what might be happening with the Taliban in Afghanistan, end quote, said McDonald. Really? How exactly? The Science Applications International Corporation, sometimes referred to as NSA West, because so many former NSA employees go on to work for the formerly California-based Science Applications International Corporation. This firm makes a ton of cash off government contracts, and they do so by hawking their expertise in combating the terrorist threat. Browse through their website and you're constantly greeted with the words terrorist threat and information on how they can help the government and others battle it. They developed a terrorism protection manual for Florida law enforcement that was developed to fight, quote, today's national terrorist threat and implement recommended security best practices. They boast of their expertise and experience meeting the terrorism incident response training needs of a wide variety of customers. Back when J.P. Jumper, the current CEO of the company, was an Air Force general, he said the threat of terrorism, quote, is greater than Nazism, greater than communism. This threat that we have of terrorist zealots is the most dangerous because these are people who care nothing about life. They care nothing about our lives, for sure, and they care nothing about their own lives, end quote. And Larry Pryor, a U.S. intelligence veteran who used to run the company's intelligence security group, said in an internal newsletter that, quote, the future of the nation rests on their backs. They have 42,000 employees, 20,000 hold U.S. government security clearances. It's the largest private contractor for the National Security Agency. And Last year, it reported a net profit of $525 million. Then you have the Center for Counterintelligence and Security Studies. The U.S. intelligence agencies aren't the only sectors of government where the private sector has cashed in on the fear of terrorism. The post-9/11 world has seen the blossoming of a cottage industry of self-styled experts on Islam from private companies that market their supposedly ironclad analysis of the threat from Islamists to other federal agencies and state and local enforcement. These companies have profited from law enforcement taking part in the war on terror. Through Homeland Security grant programs like the State Homeland Security Program and the Urban Area Security Initiative, the federal government has doled out billions and billions of our dollars to these private companies to provide Islamophobic training. One of these companies is called the Center for Counterintelligence and Security Studies. It's based in Virginia. And it posits, quote, radical Islam as a new global ideological menace on the order of the old communist threat from the Soviet Union. And their claim to fame is providing education and training to members of the U.S. national security community and law enforcement agencies. And it's unclear exactly how much the firm makes per year, but according to a report, a five-day course for government employees cost $39,280. That's for 5 days. That's what you pay as an individual. $39,000 for a week. The firm also lists the cost of individual courses of a 30-person class titled Dying to Kill Us, Understanding the Mindset of Suicide Operation costs $7,856. A three-day course on informant development costs $23,000. And they push only anti-Muslim ideology. Then finally, you have the Security Solutions International. It's yet another private firm hawking anti-Muslim training to law enforcement. This Miami-based company, founded in 2004, uses its Israeli security connections to boost its standing in the market. They use Israeli security trainers in their courses, and their president, Henry Morgenstern, is a dual Israeli-U.S. citizen who says he's, quote, developed excellent high-level contacts with the security establishment in Israel. The company has trained 700 law enforcement agencies since 2004, and they are high up on the food chain. And there they make their money off their counterterrorism magazine, and they have 15,000 subscribers to it. And just to attend one of their conferences is very expensive. So let us summarize this and put this in proper perspective. In order for us to understand what's killing Americans, the number one cause of preventable death in the United States is not terrorists. It's not anyone blowing anything up. It's American medicine. This has been independently confirmed by five scholars, medical doctors, and PhDs who spent 5 years doing a report called Death by Medicine. It's posted on the website. In it, we show that very conservatively, the lowest figure we could come up with, based upon actual figures from different medical organizations, was about 650,000 dead. But more realistic is about 730,000, and more accurate be close to 1 million. But we even take the low figure. That means more people are dying from medical errors and treatment than heart attacks or strokes or cancer or diabetes. Now, you would think that after 10 years of causing 5 million to 7 million Americans to die and over 100 million to be injured, that someone would be interested in changing it. Not a word. That's the power of the pharmaceutical industry. That's the power of the medical monopoly of only having one way of dealing with medicine and disease in this country. That's what happens when lobbyists for the pharmaceutical industry and the insurance companies and the hospitals get together and they write the legislation. That's fascism. They write the laws. They then get with members of Congress, the policymakers. They enact these laws. or at the state level, they get together with the legislative exchange people, one of the most pernicious groups in the United States, and certainly one of the most powerful. And this is ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and they lobbied for about 20,000 laws secretly over 40 years. No one even knew they existed. And they represent about 300 major corporations. So they're the ones who say that your vaccine should be mandatory. They're the ones who say that gas hydrofracking should be able to use public water supplies, even if the public is running out of water. If there's not enough water there for agriculture, industry, and the citizens, too bad. Don't touch the hydrofracking water. They're the ones who do this. That's fascism. They're the ones who make sure that you can't ban any product because it causes cancer. They're also the ones behind the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty, the most egregious, evil treaty in world history. They're behind all this. So these are the people who, by the way, have the power. And then when the people write their laws, the legislators quit, 12 of them quit after the Medicare law, and went to work for the pharmaceutical industry. One of them at $2 million a year. And that was a lot of money, but the normal exchange is 100 to 1, meaning for every $1 that industries spend on trying to control a legislator, policymaker, they're going to get $100 in return. In the case of the Medicare Act, here's what happened. They passed a law that the Veterans Administration, Medicaid and Medicare, could not go out and find the least expensive generic drugs. Let's say a 30-day supply of a heart medication might cost $10. Instead, under this law that they, the pharmaceutical industry, wrote, you will have to pay the high-end price of maybe $300. And hence, we the people pay that. And this was a bipartisan effort to write these laws. And mind you, they only help those in power. They do not help us. So when we have doctors and medicine as the number one cause of preventable death, and we're not talking about a few or a few thousand or a few hundred thousand or a few million, we're talking about 5 to 10 million in just the last 10 years, then the question is, shouldn't there be concern about that? And the answer is yes. But instead, the emphasis is upon terrorism. And it's all misguided. And that's how it works. But these are the companies that make the benefit to themselves. Now, another aspect of this is Homeland Defense. This is from Frank Morales of Global Research. Quote, the Department of Defense now authorizes the domestic deployment of U.S. troops, quote, in the conduct of operations other than war, including law enforcement activities and the quelling of civil disturbances. What does that mean? How about a protest? Any protest is now considered a civil disturbance. Quote, federal military commanders have the authority in extraordinary emergency circumstances where prior authorization by the president is impossible and duly constituted, local authorities are unable to control the situation to engage temporarily in activities that are necessary to quell large-scale unexpected civil disturbances. End quote. Well, what's that mean? Let's just say that you have 10,000 union members who want to protest the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which will destroy all unions in the United States. And so they peacefully get together and they peacefully demonstrate in Washington. That could be deemed an unexpected civil disturbance. Those people could then be targeted for arrest. These developments, which are currently the object of heated debate, are the result of more than 10 years of regressive legislation, which increasingly point to the fusion of the police and the military functions, both within the U.S. and abroad. Now, in a path-breaking article published by Global Research way back in 2003, award-winning author Frank Morales shows how the post-9/11 Patriot Act, which he describes as a repressive coordination, has set the stage for the militarization of America, namely, quote, a form of state terrorism directed against the American people and democracy itself. So the domestic war on terrorism hinges upon the Pentagon's doctrine of homeland defense, and mountains of repressive legislation are being enacted in the name of internal security, so-called homeland security, originally set within the Pentagon's operations other than war, is actually a case in which the Pentagon has declared war on America. I'm going to read some of Professor Michael Choftodovsky's statement. The Patriot Act is a repressive coordination of the entities of force and deception, the police, intelligence, and the military. It broadens, centralizes, and combines the surveillance, arrest, and harassment capabilities of the police and intelligence apparatus. Homeland defense is, in essence, a form of state terrorism directed against the American people and democracy itself. It is the Pentagon, Inc., declaring war on America. The domestic war on terrorism hinges upon the Pentagon's doctrine. And all of this is taking place amidst an increasingly perfected fusion of the police military functions both within the U.S. and abroad, where the phenomena is referred to as peacekeeping or the policization of the military. Here in America, all distinction between the military and police functions is about to be forever expunged with the looming repeal of the Posse Comitatus Act. The latter was passed after the Civil War to rein in the military. It bars federal troops from doing police work within the United States borders. Although, strictly speaking, the act refers only to the Army and the Air Force, not the Marines or the National Guard, in state statutes. The Bush administration has directed lawyers, according to the New York Times at the time, to review the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878 and any other laws that sharply restrict the military's ability to participate in domestic law enforcement. And, in other words, the New World Order and law and order, based on the repeal of the Posse Comitatus Act, requires a system of domestic and global counterinsurgency led by the Pentagon. The first requirement of this counterinsurgency, which is directed at all forms of social dissent, any of us protesting, online, in person, with letters, is the collection, retention, and dissemination of information. Information on anyone who resists, whether through violent means or otherwise. Recall that the protests in Seattle and numerous other cities in recent years were more often than not classified within the official Department of Defense and FEMA documents as terrorist events. The objective is to centralize all intelligence gathering under one roof, the Department of Homeland Security, and to widely cast the net over all of us, making certain that we are all able to fall in line with the Pentagon, Inc.'s agenda. To this end, the myriad modes of intelligence gathering or collection have been beefed up, from the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act to Carnivora, the email spying, from the National Security Agency's Echelon Global Listening Device to spy satellite imagery, from FBI roving wiretaps to the CIA's access to grand juries and secret FISA foreign intelligence courts. The means, the legal sanctions, and the technology of social control proliferate. They are sanctioned. They are demanded by a paranoid public. Homeland Security requires manufactured insecurity, a bit of anthrax to keep them on their toes and minding their P's and Q's. Typical of the need for tactical on-the-ground intelligence is the creation of TIPS, or the Terrorism Information and Prevention System, set up by John Ashcroft's Justice Department in 2002. TIPS is a hotline to the National White Collar Crime Center, a Justice Department organization that deals with economic crime and cyber attack. For a little under $1 million, they plan to register all suspicious, publicly observable activity that could be related to terrorism. In other words, anything that someone doesn't like about you, anything at all, they can call and drop a dime on you, and suddenly you're on someone's terrorist list. It doesn't matter, you haven't done anything. And with the Patriot Act and other legal monstrosities foisted upon the public, what emerges is a repressive coordination of the entities of force and deception, the police, intelligence, and the military, in the interest of a permanent counterinsurgency by way of the centralization and broadening of surveillance of Americans. So, the war on terror is a war on Americans. examples of how fascism is existing and people have gotten used to it. From Truthdig, officers reportedly beat California man to death as he begs for his life. A 33-year-old California man and father of four died after sheriff's deputies and California Highway Patrol officers responded to reports of a possible intoxicated man outside of Bakersfield Medical Center last week. Witness Ruben Sabalso, 19, said he saw two officers beating the victim with batons. Quote, they were hitting his head, so every time they would swing, I could hear the blows to his head. And the man was screaming for help, but they didn't stop. Another witness, who said his first name was John, said, quote, the man was not resisting arrest. He was begging for his life. A number of people said to have caught the incident on cell phones. Those phones, however, were seized by deputies before an arrest warrant was served. And from the Digital Journal, quote, criminal defense attorney John Tello, who is representing two of the witnesses who recorded the brutal beating, told the Californian that his clients are, quote, shaken by what they saw and how they were treated by the police. When I arrived to the home of one of the witnesses that had video footage, she was with her family sitting down on the couch surrounded by three deputies. And the witnesses were not allowed to access their own cell phones and were prevented from leaving their home. The lawyer claims he was not permitted to speak privately with the woman with the phone and that he was informed that the recording of the deadly attack was evidence of the investigation. This was not a crime scene where evidence was going to be destroyed. He told the Californian these were concerned citizens who were basically doing a civic duty by preserving the evidence, not destroying it as they tried to make it seem. Tellus also claims that the witnesses' phones were seized before any warrants were served. He also claims deputies threatened one witness, telling him he could either surrender his phone or he would be dealt with. And news outlet Bakersfield Now has released an uncut 9/11 tape from the incident, which a woman tells the dispatcher, quote, there's a man lying on the floor and your police officers are beating the S out of him and killed him. The woman then tells the dispatcher she caught the whole thing on video. Now, what is the meaning of this? The meaning is simple. Police today can do anything they want and get away with it. It is rare that anyone will be able to defend themselves because if you video, if you record someone being killed, beaten, anything by a police officer, tasered, the police will threaten you. They will confiscate your private property. And then if you resist, you will be arrested. You will be tasered. You will be hurt. That's the militarization. That's a police state, and a police state could only exist where there is either totalitarian or fascistic rule. It wouldn't exist in an open democracy where the police would be held accountable. Citizens would be encouraged to report crimes, including crimes by the police. But in our society, when Bradley Manning reported crimes, showed crimes from documents and video footage from WikiLeaks, or I should say they gave it to WikiLeaks, he was punished. He is in prison. He committed no crime against America. He did not undermine our security. We spend more in the world than anyone else, everyone else combined. So how is it that anyone's going to represent a threat to us? What the threat is telling the truth. And we're afraid of the truth. So you capture a crime by authorities, by the police, by major corporations, you then become the victim. That's fascism, supporting a police state. Let me give you a better example of this. I'll give you a couple more examples before I go to money laundering, which is rampant now. Quote from David Rose of Aldernet, arresting a teen girl for dozing off in class. Brenda Penna, a five-year-old, was told she could not return to her kindergarten class at a Bronx, New York charter school until she was psychiatrically cleared to return by a medical professional. It was her first day at a new school. She didn't know anyone and repeatedly cried, "Nobody cares about me." And administrators placed her on a list of so-called psychiatric suspensions. In Bartow, Florida, Kyra Wilmot, a 16-year-old student, was expelled from Bartow High School and arrested for conducting an unapproved chemistry experiment. She combined some household chemicals in an 8-ounce water bottle, and the top popped off. And according to the school principal, quote, she made a bad choice. And she was charged with possession of and discharging a weapon on school property. Brianna and Kira are but two examples of the growing discipline crisis besetting schools throughout the country. School administrators are resorting to an increasing number of questionable tactics to address problems. These include using local EMS workers and police to arrest people. A high school student in Hoover, Alabama, was recently beaten by a school official and then arrested for falling asleep in school. A young girl named Avery is not a typical teenager. She suffers from diabetes, asthma, and sleep apnea. Sadly, while sitting in the in-school suspension room and reading Huckleberry Finn, she dozed off. She asserts that the classroom supervisor seized the book and hit her on the head with it. And the police were called, and the girl was forcibly arrested, causing her to have a seizure, vomit, and pass out and end up in the hospital. But she was arrested. To enforce discipline, school systems across the country are employing harsher techniques and turning to the local police. And that is going on all over the place. In Georgia, school misbehavior incidents bring in the local police. In Georgia, a small town school about 90 miles from Atlanta, a Cecilia Johnson, a six-year-old student, 6 years old, was in elementary school and was handcuffed and taken away in a patrol car at the police station. According to the Baldwin County School Superintendent, the police were called due to Johnson's disruptive behavior and a six-year-old handcuffed and arrested. Texas police tase overweight asthmatic to death in a drug raid that uncovers no drugs. Quote, Fort Worth police entered the home of Jermaine Darden, 34, in search of cocaine. The raid, which does not appear to have uncovered any cocaine, ended with the 34-year-old father dead after police tased him multiple times. Family members told CBS 11 that the 350-pound man who had been asleep on the couch, police came in, couldn't drop to the ground on his stomach as officers commanded because he suffered from asthma. Quote, they physically pulled him off the couch. He was asleep. Pulled him off the couch and they tried to put him on his stomach. He can't breathe on his stomach. And so they tasered him until he died. Nothing will happen to the police, of course. So that is an example of how they're getting away with murder. And this is happening everywhere. Money laundering and the global drug trade are fueled by the elites. Quote, from Tom Burghardt. When investigative journalist Daniel Hopsicker broke the story 4 years ago that a DC-9 registered to a company which once used as its address the hangar of Huffman Aviation, the flight school at the Venice, Florida airport, which trained both terrorist pilots who crashed planes into the World Trade Center, was caught by the Mexican military, carrying 5 tons of cocaine destined for the U.S. That elicited virtually no media. And when authorities searched the plane and found its cargo consisted solely of 128 identical black suitcases marked private, packed with cocaine, valued at $100 million, the silence was deafening. But now a Bloomberg Markets Magazine report, Wachovia's Drug Habit, reveals that drug traffickers bought that plane and perhaps 50 others, quote, with laundered money funds they transferred through two of the biggest banks in the United States, Bank of America and Wachovia. The Justice Department's charge sheet against the bank tells us that between 2003 and 2008, Wachovia handled $378 billion of Mexican currency exchanges, the largest violation of the Bank Securities Act and Anti-Money Laundering Act in U.S. history. A sum Bloomberg said equaled 1/3 of Mexico's current gross domestic product. Since 2006, some 22,000 people have been killed in drug-related violence, and tens of thousands more are bystander deaths from this. In a frightening echo of the Reagan administration's anti-communist jihad in Central America during the 1980s, the Bush and now Obama administrations have poured fuel on the fire with some $1.4 billion and more on drugs funding under Plan Merida. Much of the aid is destined to purchase military equipment for repressive police specializing with paramilitary units in the Mexican army. There's also evidence that direct U.S. military involvement. In June, the Narco News Bulletin reported that a special operations task force under the command of the Pentagon is currently in place south of the border, providing advice and training to the Mexican army and gathering intelligence, infiltrating as needed, taking direct action against narco trafficking organizations. One former U.S. government official told investigative journalist Bill Conroy, quote, "Black operations have been going on forever. The recent mainstream media reports about those operations under the Obama administration make it sound like it's a big scoop, but it's nothing new for those who understand how things really work." But as numerous investigations by American and Mexican journalists have revealed, there's a strong evidence that collusion between the Mexican army and the Juarez and Sinaloa drug cartels. A former Juarez police commander told NPR that the, quote, intention of the army is to try and get rid of the Juarez cartel so that El Chapo Guzman cartel is the strongest. The cozy relations among the world's biggest banks, drug trafficking organizations, U.S. military intelligence apparatus is not, however, a new phenomenon. What is different today is the scale and sheer scope of the corruption involved. As Professor Michael Chostovsky points out, quote, "This trade can only prosper if the main actors involved in narcotics have political friends in high places. As legal and illegal undertakings are increasingly intertwined, the dividing line between business people and criminals is blurred. In turn, the relationship among criminals, politicians, and members of the intelligence establishment has tainted the structures, the state, and the role it institutes." While Bloomberg's story should cast new light on highly profitable links amongst major financial institutions, narco-trafficking organizations, and what may be protected drug rackets greenlighted by corrupt officials, media silence, particularly by outlets such as the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times. So the bottom line to this whole article was that hundreds of billions of dollars of drug money ended up in these banks, and the banks then launder that money. They knew full well that it was bad money. They paid a small fine, not even 5% of their ill-gotten gains. They got to keep all their profits. Nobody went to jail. No one personally was charged, and the company's reputation remains intact. How does this happen? Who's behind all this? Well, there are some people who are the most powerful people in the United States. Educating yourself about the empire that these people run can be a challenging endeavor, according to Andrew Gavin Marshall, especially since so much of the educational system is dedicated to avoiding the topic or justifying the actions of imperialism in modern era. If one studies political science or economics, the subject might be discussed in a historical context. But let me tell you something, you will not find anyone in mainstream institutions dealing with the fact that this is happening today. Instead, we exist in a society where institutions and individuals of power speak in coded language, using deceptive rhetoric with abstract meaning. We hear about democracy and freedom and security, but so rarely about imperialism, domination, exploitation, fascism, totalitarianism. The objective of this is to provide an introduction to the institutional and social structure of American imperialism. And from that imperialism, you breed totalitarianism and fascism. And it is detailed, and it is scholarly. First, let's begin with who tells us to go to war? Who tells us which drugs to take? Who tells us what curriculums are good and what kind of schools are good? The charter schools are good, but community schools are bad. Who tells us who we should vote for? Who selects the people that we're going to vote for? Who chooses them? and then grooms them over a period of time, who is always on the receiving end of profit and never has to be responsible for loss. It's the same people. It's the think tanks. The think tanks bring together prominent academics, former top government officials, corporate executives, bankers, media representatives, foundation officials, and other elites in an effort to establish consensus on issues of policy and strategy. And through that consensus, they produce reports and recommendations for policymakers and functioning as recruitment centers for those who are selected to key government positions where they have the ability to implement policies. Thus, think tanks function as the intellectual engines of empire. They establish consensus among elites, provide policy prescriptions, strategic recommendations, and the personnel required to implement imperial policies through government agencies. So, for example, when the president says that we should punish Syria, all the different talk shows, radio and television, will have a group from different think tanks on to support it. They may have a little different approach to it. They may be partisan, but they're still supportive of it. That's why I'm surprised and appalled by MSNBC and others who know better but will not bring on truly progressive independent individuals to challenge this. Now, among the most prominent American and international think tanks are the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderberg Meetings, the Trilateral Commission, the Center for Strategic International Studies, the Brookings Institute, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, the Atlantic Council, and these institutions tend to rely upon funding from major foundations, the Rockefeller, Ford, and Carnegie Foundations, for example, as well as corporations and financial institutions, and even various government agencies. There is an extensive crossover in leadership and membership between these institutions and between them and their funders. And roughly focusing on the period, just let's say the early 1970s till today, what emerges from this research is a highly integrated network of foreign policy elites with individuals like Henry Kissinger and Zygmunt Brzezinski and Brent Scowcroft and Joseph Nye figuring prominently and sitting at the center of the American imperial fascistic establishment over the course of decades. Now, mind you, with powerful corporate and financial patrons like the Rockefeller family, they're always in the background. And within the United States government, the National Security Council functions as the main planning group, devising strategy and policies for the operation of American power in the world. And the National Security Council coordinates multiple government agencies and State Department, Defense Department, CIA, Joint Chiefs of Staff, and various other government bodies with meetings directed by the National Security Advisor, who is generally one of the president's most trusted and influential advisors. In several administrations, the National Security Advisor became the most influential voice and policymaker in foreign policy, such as during the Nixon administration, Henry Kissinger, the Carter administration, Brzezinski. While both of these individuals were top government officials in the 1970s, their influence has not declined in the decades since they held such positions. In fact, it could be argued that both of their influence is still increasing today. In fact, in January of this year, an interview with The Hill, Brzezinski said, quote, "To be perfectly frank, and you may not believe me, I really wasn't at all conscious of the fact that the defeat of Carter administration 1980 somehow or another affected significantly my own standing. I just kept going on and doing the Midas, minus the Office of National Security Advisor at the White House." Well, of course he did. And General Brent Scowcroft, who was National Security Advisor under Presidents Ford and George W. Bush, was Kissinger's National Security Advisor in the Nixon administration. And Brzezinski, Carter's National Security Advisor, served on the faculty of Harvard with Kissinger and also served with Kissinger on the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board during the Reagan administration. Both of them are members and at time board members of the Council on Foreign Relations, as well as members of the Trilateral Commission, and they're both currently trustees at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And other national security agencies with connections to Kissinger include Richard Allen under Reagan, who worked with Kissinger in the Nixon administration, William Clark under Reagan, who worked with Kissinger's former aide, Alexander Haig, at the State Department, Robert McFarlane, and John Poindexter, and Frank Carlucci, and these Colin Powell. All these people know each other. They all work together. Anthony Lake, Clinton's national security advisor, worked directly with Kissinger. Samuel Berger, also national security advisor, worked for Clinton, was Lake's deputy. Condoleezza Rice, national security advisor for George Bush, worked with Scowcroft's staff. And Stephen Hadley also worked with Kissinger. The foreign policy establishment consists of top officials of the key government agencies concerned with managing foreign policy, the State Department, Pentagon, CIA, and National Security Agency, drawing upon officials from within the think tank community, where they become well acquainted with corporate and financial elites and thus become familiar with the interests of their group and the people. You never hear them talking badly about each other. You never hear them writing tell-all books. You never see them going against each other. They can't. No less significant in assessing influence with the foreign policy establishment is the relative proximity and relationship individuals have with deeply entrenched power structures, notably the financial and corporate dynasties. Arguably, both Kissinger and Brzezinski are two of the most influential individuals within the foreign policy elite, but that's because of their association with the Rockefeller family. And you have to understand that behind the policymakers, behind those that go from a government position to a foundation to a think tank, there are the financial interests and the dynasties. Dynastic power relies upon a complex network of relationships and interactions between institutions, individuals, and ideologies. And through most of human history, in most places in the world, power was wielded by relatively few people and often concentrated among the dynastic family structure, whether it was Egypt, Imperial Rome, ancient China, the Ottoman Empire, European monarchs. They spread their empires across the globe. And with the rise of the state capitalist society, dynastic power shifted from the overtly political to the financial and economic spheres. Today's main dynasties are both corporate and banking, maintained through family lines and extended through family ties. Hence, the Rockefellers are arguably the most influential dynasty in America in its history. They're comparable to the Rothschilds in France and the United Kingdom, and the Wallenbergs in Sweden, and the Desmarais family in Canada. These families are themselves connected through institutions like the Bilderberg Group and the Trilateral Commission, which they founded. Among others, the power of a corporate financial dynasty is not given. It must be maintained and nurtured and strengthened. The Rockefeller family has existed at the center of American power for over a century. Originated in the 19th century, the robber baron industrialists, the Rockefellers established an oil empire and subsequently a banking empire. And John D. Rockefeller, who had a personal fortune surpassing $1 billion, today that would be $100 billion, in the first decade of the 20th century, also founded the University of Chicago, and through the creation of activities of the Rockefeller Foundation, founded in 1913, helped engineer higher education and social sciences. And the Rockefeller family, largely acting through various family foundations, were pivotal in the founding and funding of several prominent think tanks. They created the Council on Foreign Relations. They created the Asia Society, the Trilateral Commission, the Group of 30, and the Bilderberg Group. They created all these. And the patriarch of the Rockefeller family is alive today, David Rockefeller, now in his late 90s. And to understand the influence wielded by unelected bankers and billionaires like Rockefeller, it would be useful to simply examine the positions he has held throughout his life. From 1969 to 1980, he was the chairman and CEO of Chase Manhattan Bank. And then from 1981 to 1999, he was chairman of the International Advisory Committee of Chase Manhattan. And that's when it merged. And he also was the founder of the Bilderberg Group. He was founder on Council on Foreign Relations. In fact, he was chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations from 1970 to 1985. And he still remains to this day honorary chairman. And he is chairman emeritus of the Board of Trustees of the University of Chicago. They're interconnected into everything. And there are people who don't appreciate this. They like to think that the people in power are the ones calling the shots. They are not. The true power to create the empire through which It is controlled by a police state mindset where fascism is the rule of the day and totalitarianism is the power behind it. You have your rich financial elite families. From those families come foundations. From those foundations come think tanks and charities and trusts. And then they groom people, bring them in, and see that they're on multiple boards and that they're working cross-pollinating between government agencies and major positions of trust. Then they're the ones on these think tanks who are invited to give public opinion. But behind that public opinion, they're mouthing, the generals are mouthing about the threat of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Behind all that are the ideologues, the real power, the old, withered people sitting in their mansions and deciding how they want to play the world. And then they unleash an army of activists, publicists, think tank, so-called experts, and the media they control. And hence the public is never given the true facts of who are these intellectuals, who are these so-called experts. They are all in the pocket, every single one of them, of the elite. I'm Gary Nall. This has been an extension of our series on fascism in the United States. So if you want to know why we're going into Syria and why we went into Libya and why we're having the private-public partnerships and why we have become a nation where people fear their government, and rightly so, and why you no longer have a constitution or a bill of rights, it's because we are not paying attention to the people who have the real power and the people that then go out and do their bidding. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you very much for listening.